G'day, welcome back. We got a ripper this week, but before we get into that with the big man himself, have you got yourself a pair of Tekkers eyewear yet? Nice pair of sunnies for the summer coming up, or they've even got the old blue light glasses. If you're one of those guys who spends a little bit too much time staring at a screen, maybe you get sore eyes. Have you looked into blue light glasses? I don't know. Huberman seems to think that they work. So jump on the Tekkers website, have a look, and if you do, see something you like, use the old discount code TOPO20, you get yourself 20% off. And it's a pretty good deal. But we'll leave you there, rip into it this week, and enjoy. Oh, and leave us a review. That'd be bloody nice. Tonight we have on a dad, a hunter, an optometrist, and a podcaster. He loves exploring the life less ordinary. Welcome to Topographical, Ryan Stagg O'Connor. How are you?
Good, mate. That's some intro.
No, it's trying to make it the bee's knees and give some sort of a brief insight to anyone who may not know who you are. But if you're listening to this, you probably already know of the Stagg Rule, I'd say.
Hope so. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Nice to connect.
Yeah. All right. Got a couple of quick fire questions to run off. The first has been left for you by a previous guest.
Yep.
And this is, what is your greatest achievement?
What was that old Bears and Beards, was it?
It was Stu, yeah.
Oh, greatest achievement. Nicole's sitting over there, she's smirking. Oh, you brought up a couple of them there, optometry and being a dad. The optometry thing was something I wanted to do since I was 12, so to finally get that done was pretty good. And then it was kind of like, oh, shit, now I've got the rest of my life to do stuff. So, yeah, that was a pretty big achievement. And then, yeah, every day being a dad, you're like, oh, yeah, got through another one of those.
I imagine there are some absolute shocking days, both being a dad and an optometrist, and there's also some outstanding days.
Yeah, well, both of them are dealing with humans, aren't they?
And, yeah.
When you're dealing with something, I think losing your sight's kind of like people's second biggest fear behind getting cancer. And so people come in with just the most intense animosity. It's quite remarkable. So, yeah, it can go one of two ways. Thankfully, it mostly goes down a good track. But there has been the odd time in my 10 years where I've gone, what the hell happened there?
What boots do you run? And maybe even because you do a bit of running as well, if not boots, what shoes do you run in?
So that's a good crossover question, that one. So boots, I have those lower high-topped, they're like the Tibet, but they're high-topped, and then they've got Primaloft in them. There may be something like Mountain GDX, but I don't think that's quite right. I bought them about 8 years ago, imported them from the UK. A friend had got them and got stung by duty free. So, well, not duty free, by duty. Yeah, so they ended up being like a $800 or $900 boot by the end of that. So that was a bit disappointing.
I did the same thing with a tent, and it ended up being like a $2,000 tent.
Oh,
yeah, stupidity.
Yeah, that's the game we play. I think it still would have been cheaper, not by much, but then buying it in the country. Yeah, I don't see them around too often. And then especially around up here in the Central Plateau. So going, I've done it in the Kaimais, I've done it in Porioras, and I've done it in Kaimana. Is just rock my Solomon Speedcross 6s, which is what I also run in, or have been running in for the last 3 years here.
Yeah, okay. That's good. That easy country, and if you're doing day trip stuff or warm weather stuff or certain things, hunting in or hiking in your like trail running shoes, it's epic, eh? Because it's so much lighter. If you're doing river crossings, you just go across, you get your feet wet. As long as you're not worried about ice and snow, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, well, even when I did the Southern Access in April into the remote experience zone, that's 18K. I had one of the Mystery Ranch packs from Grant with me. It wasn't quite the Metcalf. It was one that hadn't been released yet.
Yep.
And so I probably had 20 kgs on the back, and I went all the way through that 18 k's and those. My feet did get wet because it was raining, but I had one of the ultralight frame packs. There was a 75 liter thing that was 2 kgs. It was bloody awesome.
And was that on the standard, like on the standard frame, but it was a like an ultralight bag?
Yeah, and the waist strap was a little lighter. So myself and Ryan Nicholson are going to go probably to the Roy Hennies in November for three nights. You know, I'm going to take that Metcalf, I think, which is a bit more sturdy in the harness.
They're bloody good packs, those Mystery Ranch, eh? I quite like mine.
Yeah, me and Cam were having a discussion the other day because he was using one on that elk hunt that he sort of released on his story the other day.
Yeah.
And then he had the meat bag packed in there, and it was all sort of skew whiff and so on. So, and I was trying to like talk to him back and forth. I don't know where he is, if he's still in the States or what, but it was quite a disjointed conversation. I was like, you can like hook that game bag onto the frame and it fits really big and really good. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, oh, under those like reflector straps, there's a little tab and they clip into the frame. And then it finally turned out, we weren't using Mystery Ranch game bags. We were using something else.
Yeah.
That all makes sense.
Yeah, the whole load shelf setup is, if you haven't got the right like meat bag or dry bag or whatever it is that you're putting that extra thing into, it can be hard to get it to like sit properly between the frame and the bag. It can get quite ugly, eh?
Yeah, especially when you're trying to carry out a one-third of an elk.
I can't, like...
Or Wapiti, as it would probably be called, but anyhow.
I think
that name is long gone since since Joe Rogan and Meat Eater and Cameron Haynes and whoever, everybody else in the States have called it elk, so...
Yeah, it is. It's what it is now, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think they're only Wapiti in Fiordland.
I wonder if any of the reservation hunts, if they still call them Wapiti or not.
Yeah, because it's probably a name that comes from a certain tribe or nation or whatever. I think they call them nations.
Yeah,
it's probably a name that is from a certain like specific part of the Native American culture that maybe different tribes or call it something different. It'd be an interesting Google, figure that out.
Is it send it, mate? Oh, there's somebody on Instagram that's been writing articles for Meat Eater lately. He did the that North Canterbury Primary School that tried to do the wildcat hunt.
Yeah,
he wrote about that for Meat Eater, and then he's talked about invasive species in Australia as well. I think he wrote another article for Meat Eater about Roosevelt donating gifting the Wapiti to New Zealand. So he'll have to get on to figuring out why that name's been so lost.
Yeah,
because he's in that. Wapiti Book of Bamwells, he just goes to town. He hates the idea that they're called something that they're not.
Oh, yeah. Because they, well, it's an interesting thing because they, there's, so the Wapiti or elk, whatever you want to call them, that we have here are Rocky Mountain elk. There are
No,
also, no, they are, aren't they?
they're
They're gifted by,
Nelsoni.
they're what,
They're
sorry?
Nelsoni, so
Oh.
they're different again.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's, because what is there, the four, there's Nelsoni, Rocky Mountain,
Hold
Tooley,
on,
and
Cole.
you've got your book there,
It's over on the bookshelf.
haven't you?
Yes, like subspecies, eh? There's tons of them. Seasonal migrations. Bulls in the rut. Here they go. Subspecies. So you got the Tian Shan Whoppity. Yeah, so there's what, six in Asia. Then your North American, yeah, your Rooseveltie, your Nelsoni, Manitobanensis, so that's sort of Saskatchewan, southwest Manitoba, and the Nenodes, which is the Chill Whoppity that you're bringing up from California.
So there's quite a bit there, right? Yeah. It's interesting, in a lot of Europe, they refer to moose as elk,
And that's correct.
and moose are, yeah, they refer to what we know as moose, which are once again different. There's a whole bunch of moose species or moose subspecies or however it is. But yeah, they call them an elk, don't they?
Yeah. I wonder if he talked much international moose or elk. Yeah, like you say, that's what they call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the incorrect application of the term elk in North America to the Wapiti has caused a great deal of confusion over the years, as has already been explained in the earlier section. More than explained, man,
As
he
he
goes
goes
on.
right into it. Yeah. And that's in the Banwell book that you've been,
Wapiti,
yeah, Wapiti Moose, which you have been reading these books as part of podcast episodes for the Stagwell, haven't you? Or reading the sections of them.
the trophy section. So,
Yeah.
on Sunday that was the last of the
Fellow?
fallow deer. Yeah, there was 30 of those, and now I've got the red deer. The two volumes of the red deer are a little bit different how he's done it. So he did a part one and a part two, and in the part one he sort of talked about the North Island herds, and then in the part two he's talked about the South Island herds, and he gave like examples of good representative trophies, I suppose, out of each traditional herd. And then in the end of part two he has the records, so the record for length, the record for spread, the record for times, maybe the record for points, yeah, and a few of them are sort of equaled. So there's only sort of he only really summarizes sort of eight or nine animals in there. So yeah, so I think when it comes to the red, I'll go through those, and then I'll go through the representative ones of each of the herds. So because there's plenty there. And have you read his one that's from about the 60s, where he goes over the Wapiti and the Red Deer trophies from back then?
No, I haven't actually read any of them. I've looked over a couple of them, but quite a
Well,
shocking reader. If I'm not into a book fully in the first like page or so, I just put it down and move on. Like I just can't. Reading's not my favorite thing, and I don't actually read a lot, but when I do, you will not get me to stop reading that book. It's kind of, yeah. So I haven't actually dived into any of his, but
I'm a real geek for it, so like I want to be have a deer farm as well. So I'm pretty sure it's just about deer anywho.
Yeah.
And like I didn't get into optometry straight away, so I went to down to one from Invercargill, but went back down to Dunedin for 2 years, and as part of that I did a little bit of genetics. And then you start reading about deer farming and deer genetics, and obviously all agriculture, and it's all the sort of genetic based stuff, and it all starts to land. And then, so when I was studying genetics, it kind of had no purpose, but then now I look at it in terms of agriculture.
In terms of the deer farming sort of concept of it. Yeah.
I can just like geek out of it. So I love going to the deer sales and just like looking at all the pedigrees of the stags and hinds that we have in New Zealand.
That was in my notes to talk to you about the deer farming thing, because it's something that I know that you're mad keen on. Where did that come from? Like, did that, prior to doing the genetics, were you into deer and deer farming? Was that part of it, or was it through the genetic thing and through hunting? Like, how did that all come?
I think it's just all of a combination, really. Like, growing up in Southland, obviously there's a shit ton of deer farms down there, and we have family friends that have a beautiful deer farm at the end of the Hokonui Hills near Dipton, sort of Dipton belt way. And like, growing up, we used to go there, and it was just kind of like sort of overwhelming that you'd have these gigantic fences and these massive semi-wild animals behind fences, and Peter tell yarns about, you know, trying to get the stag out at the end of mating and basically open the gate, driving in his two-wheeler until the stag started chasing him, and then he'd drive out the gate and turn the corner and the stag would run off and close the gate again.
Shut the gate behind it.
God's sake. And, you know, and then you watch, like, Deer Wars. I've lost count how many times I've watched that.
Yeah.
At Invercargill Airport, there's Hannibal Hayes, a mural of Hannibal Hayes on at the baggage collect, you know, and you know, you'd see things in the paper about helicopters operating around Fiordland. Deer was sort of there, but I was always playing sports, so I never went hunting. I had this idea of being an optometrist, so I was pretty narrow-minded on that too. And then sort of whilst I was at Otago and looking at what am I going to do if I don't get into optometry, I was like, oh, maybe I'll go home, play rugby, you know, try getting the Southland Stags, you know, maybe build or something like that. But, yeah, and then as sort of uni went on, I kept having this itch about deer and hunting and deer farming. And so once I'd finished uni, I went through Telford and did level 3 deer knowledge via correspondence.
Yeah.
And then just via that, I needed to go and talk to some deer farmers to sort of ask questions about how to operate one. And so met Bill Robinson, who was manager of Rarawa Deer Stud near Cambridge. And from there, started going to the sort of next generation deer farming conferences. I've been to 3 of those now, and it's always pretty funny when people ask me, like, oh, what farm are you on? I'm like, none. I'm not talking.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's, you know, Hawke's Bay, not so much when I was in Waikato, but yeah, Hawke's Bay and now Taupo and Tokoroi, you know, there's plenty of current and ex deer farmers coming to work, and I just end up having, or ex deer colours, I just end up having big yarns to them and run late, but it's all right.
You got to chase the passion, don't you?
Yeah. It's been quite good though. I've been back to hunting books. I've been given quite a few hunting books from patients. Hey, they're all.
Oh shit, like, that's cool.
Have you read this one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bloody good. So you just said that you weren't hunting a lot because you were mad on your sports. I think if I'm correct, like, you were mad in water polo and rugby were your big things?
Yeah, and football at high school as well. So
yeah, okay.
Being a small pond, basically at 13 started playing men's grade, maybe even 12, can't remember. Jesus. But and so then it was sort of Southern Region had representative stuff, and then there was a sort of a men's competition within that Southern Region, and I think I had a couple of games when I was 15, and then when I was 17 I was playing that. Played a couple of seasons of National Youth League in football, which was real fun. We got to go around the country and play soccer, a bunch of 17 and 16 year olds. And yeah, so then I moved to Auckland and tried playing soccer up there and didn't really make much headway. Realised that I wasn't going to get into optometry and kind of had a bit of an existential crisis and changed to playing rugby.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, oh, and prior to the soccer, I was a keen swimmer. So that's why I was reasonably good at water polo too.
Yeah. Okay.
So I just, yeah, had this like real kind of, if I'm going to play sport, going to do it.
Play it hard and.
Yeah. Do it as good as I possibly can. Yeah. And because I moved to Dunedin, I hadn't been in the halls and didn't have a flat to go to. I found out on like Waitangi Day that I wasn't going back to Auckland. So had about a week to figure myself out. Stayed a week on my mate's couch during a week, which didn't really matter, did it? Because
no.
kind of slept where you lay. And yeah, moved in with guys that were a year older. And one of the guys there was like, oh, the Polytech run this thing called like a rugby academy, and you get like a little certificate in sports coaching from doing it, but it's sort of connected to the Otago Rugby Union. So I did that, and yeah, that sort of helped me to figure out the more intricacies of rugby. Then went up to Auckland and was playing for varsity when I went back up there and started playing a lot of sevens, and I was home in Invercargill, and Mum and I went to the Southland Sports Awards on behalf of my dad, and we were just sitting next to this guy who's a rugby manager, and I said to him, oh, like, that Southland Sevens team, what are they like? You know, do they sort of train or anything like that? He's like, oh, to a certain extent. And I was like, oh, do you reckon I'd be able to play? He's like, oh, yeah, I'll put your name forward. I'll put you in touch with the right people. So, yeah, sort of the end of the year, rocked up to Southland training and went to the qualifying tournament. We did quite well. We made the final and narrowly lost to Canterbury. And so I was in that squad, and then did that the year after. And then same again when I moved to Christchurch, I was in the Canterbury squad there. So, yeah, it was just like massive desire to do it as best as I possibly could, even though possibly sometimes I shouldn't have been there, but it's pretty name for give it your all, and it's amazing where you can end up, eh?
Yeah, it is, eh? It is. It's with the amount that you're doing there of the sport and whatnot, and doing reasonably well in a few of those, especially when it comes to the rugby there. That's like, I'm just trying to go back to, you were talking earlier about how you just didn't get to do a lot of hunting because of all the sports. Like, that must have been very intensive weeks, like your week's training and playing schedule.
Yeah, football, like especially with that youth league, we'd be training in Dunedin. So me and a couple of mates would finish early on a Wednesday. His dad would drive us, or our coach would drive us up to Dunedin, would train, and then drive home again, and then we'd have trainings on Tuesdays and Thursdays locally, play on a Saturday, and then have youth league training again on a Sunday, and then once the season came around, would be off, you know, around the country on the weekend. Yeah, it was pretty gnarly. Like, but that's the other beautiful thing about Invercargill. You could be like, you know, I was playing volleyball, water polo, soccer, so, and then also doing, you know, musical productions at school as well. So you could just like do so much. It was
just
doing
everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Needless to say, when I got to uni, I didn't know how to study because I thought what I'd done at high school was going to be good enough, and it wasn't.
Yeah, I had the same thing, and it didn't work out for me.
Was it Lincoln? Was it?
I went to Lincoln, and before the end of the year, I realised that this is not where I need to be.
What did you have intentions of doing?
That's a good question. I was studying to do ag science, but did I really have intentions of doing that? I don't know. I think it was just kind of where I ended up, not through anything. Unlike you with your optometry, where you knew you wanted to do it, like, shit, I still don't know what I want to do. So doing, I don't know. Like, I did that, and then I think I did like 7 or 8 papers for the year, and I think I only like passed 2 or 3 of them or something. Like, just, it was not where I needed to be at that time.
So did you go straight into the guiding thing, or did you have a bit of a mosey around for a bit?
No, I ended up going, when I left there, it was the earthquakes had just happened in Christchurch, and I didn't know what I was doing in my life, but I'd made heaps of friends that were there, heaps of friends from school were there. I'd already organized a flat for the next year, and I was like, fuck it, I'll just stay here. I'll get a job with a construction company somewhere as a laborer, and I'll figure my shit out. And I ended up getting a job with a company and stayed there for 8 years. They put me through some study at Polytech, which once again, I started in engineering and shat the bed there, and eventually wound up in doing architectural technology, and finally actually cracked that out. And then the day I found out that I'd passed, I emailed my boss and said, we need to have a meeting tomorrow, I'm leaving. And I, that's when I started the guiding thing. It was something that I'd wanted to do for a while, so that's when I did that. And then,
how did that all go up? Who'd you do it through?
That was with, so, mate Todd Howard, who I didn't really grow up with him, but like knew him from up north from Whangarei, and he was already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a few people that had like gone and done it and over in Canada. And so I just messaged Todd and was like, yo, how do I like sort out a job? And he just come back and said, yeah, bro, come work with us.
Yes.
Turned up over there, not having actually met the people I was working for. I met them when I got there. Like, I hadn't talked to them or anything. And then that's how I, and just, yeah, did 2
how did the visas work? Did you have to?
Yeah, you got to get a visa.
Did you go to that travel, three-year travel visa?
It's a two-year work visa thing. It's actually only 23 months, I found out. Which, like, as far as the guiding seasons go, it kind of limits you to 2 seasons.
Yeah.
And that's it, just because it, like...
Did you jump the border at all, or...?
Nah, I went over there, I think, a week after I got there. I went into the bush for, I think the first season was 77 days, came out, spent a couple, maybe another week at the ranch before I did a trip to town, and then it was back there and just kept guiding. And then when it time come, like 5.5, 6 months later, I got on a plane and flew home.
What was the state there when you got on the planes, and then when you met people from home 2 years later, what did they think of you?
Well, I came home, I went over for 6 months, came home, and then went over again the next season. But the, I don't know, it was real weird coming back out of the bush, like, after being that long. Like, I remember the first time.
I'm pretty feral.
No, not like real feral, because I mean, we
with the,
yeah, you're with clients, but also we had a reasonably, I don't want to say luxury, but like I was in a camp where life was pretty good. Like there was multiple guides, there was always a wrangler, there was a cook. Like it was pretty, you know. Whereas some of the guys that are doing it way more hard yards than how I was doing it, but. You're on a horse all day, and that's like a horse is the fastest thing you've been on. And you're never, like, you're never running a horse. You're always walking them. You might trot them sometimes. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you like jump in the truck and drive to town, and you're doing like 100K an hour down the road. You're like, holy fuck. You know?
You didn't get fixed wind or chop it in anywhere?
Nah, I didn't. So I rode into camp and then. The clients would fly in and out, and I never changed camp other than on horse. So I rode in, rode out. A lot of the guys do fly in stuff and things like that. But
did you have to take a team of pack horses with you, or that stuff's already there?
Yeah, no, you take a, so you, like, you trail into camp with, I don't know, somewhere between like 10 and 20 horses, depending on how many guides and whatnot. Like you've got, you'd have a horse, typically you'd have like two horses that were like designated as like your horse, so you just alternate days of riding those horses. So every guide's got, say, two horses, and then maybe every guide's also got two hunter horses, and then you might have a pack horses as well. So like if you've got a big camp, like if you've got a guide and two or three guides and a wrangler and a cook and a bunch of hunters, like fuck, you can end up with a lot of horses.
Yeah.
So.
And so how would you attack the blocks? Did the sort of people that run the blocks know round about where things were, or you were sort of scouting around on the horses and glassing and stuff, or how'd you sort of navigate the hunting?
So that's where we were. You're in. There's not like. Blocks as such. Just imagine you've got like you're going into like a national park, and you've got the right to guide in just this massive area that does cover, like, in their rule book they have a few different like management units, and you're like the outfit we guided for had a, like, the area covered a few different management units, but you just get sent, like, you're going to this camp, and then from that camp, there's only sort of so much area you can hunt within a day, or decide to do overnighters, you know. But you might do a three-hour ride on a horse to get to an area and then ride back at the end of the day. So, like, you do cover a fair bit of ground, but you're not – you just kind of – especially when you first get there, you're just told, like, this is where you go to get these kind of animals. Like, this is the places. Because you turn up there, you don't know. Like, when I got there, I didn't know shit, you know. And, like, I got there when I started as a wrangler. But through some sort of unfortunate circumstances, I ended up guiding really quickly just because we were shy of a guide. And so, like, I got chucked in the deep end and swam, but definitely did not swim well. Yeah, but it's good fun, eh? It's good fun. So how did, like, hunting start for you? How did you?
Yeah, so I had gone back to Auckland, and the next year I was sort of pretty keen to go hunting, but I just, it's like one of those things, like, where do you start? And thankfully my cousin, he had finished up at Otago Boys and was doing outdoor education at Otago Polytech, and my uncle's a forestry consultant, and so his summer holidays was either pruning or something in Waipori. And so him and these group of guys that were doing outdoor education were all on a hunt at Waipori, and I was down for a 21st. And so I just was like, oh, I'll come. And so we just sort of walked around in the mist, saw some big sign and not a lot else. I think we had a shot in anger just for, to like let off a shot. And that was the first, my first hunting experience. For some reason I already had like a hunting and fishing cyclone jacket, which turns out it's not overly waterproof, but did the job. It was like a bush or anything.
Not rated for cyclones at all.
No. And just growing up, like dad, he's grew up in Dunedin. He had gone to Waikaia as a kid, to a small farm between Argyle and Glenery Station. And my grandpa had also gone there. That was, it was sort of one of their relations. And my grandpa talked about just like going out onto the sweet paddock and there'd be mobs of deer, or like they'd chase them up onto the first terrace and then, you know, shoot a few deer. Whereas dad just sort of did possum shooting and rabbit shooting. And it wasn't until later that I sort of asked him, I was like, why did you never do hunting? And he was like, well, late 70s, early 80s, all those deer that had been on sweet paddocks and terraces were now behind wire on Argyle and Glenery Station. So it was like nothing left to hunt. And so that was kind of why it sort of skipped a generation. But yeah, he sort of would go rabbit shooting with the 22 and possum shooting. We went up to Waikaia once and possum shot all the willows along the river and things like that. But yeah, so I'd fired the 22 a couple of times and rabbit shot around Wanaka a bit. And then either my second or last year in Auckland, me and some guys that I'd floated with in Dunedin, one who I grew up with in Invercargill and another one from Hawke's Bay, we won a Timaru Creek ballot. And yeah, we went hunting there. I was carrying like a pole frame pack. you know, it's got like the two poles on the side and the straps go from the bottom pole to the top of the pole either side. So that was freaking uncomfortable. I think I was wearing like work boots that are fireproof work boots that had Velcro on them. So like no laces, they just like Velcroed down. I had those from working at the aluminium smelter. I had some gaiters and my cyclone bush shirt. And we went in there not really knowing how to hunt. Hedley had sort of poked his nose around Wanaka a little bit. He was living there, working on the ski fields. We ended up sitting above this wallow, which we found out the week before a 14 pointer had been shot on, and my mate shot a spiker. And then he got stung by a wasp and his eye popped. So we went the next day and we had a pop shot at this mob of tar, like way too far off, like the most steep angle ever, in the tight stuff on the creek that goes up to Moonlight and Roses, if anyone's been in there. And then the next day his eyelid was all blown up. So we walked out of the Timaru Creek and went home, and that was that. And then Daniel and I, the mate I grew up with in Invercargill, we went into Timaru Creek a couple of times. Like we stayed at the Junction Hut, and then we went up to Moonlight and Roses Hut one weekend. I started hunting the fallow blocks near Cambridge, and then the Kaimais, and then I went to Australia, and so I had a little bit of a gap there. And then when I came back, when I moved to Hawke's Bay, I started going to the Kawikas. And in 2020, well, just after COVID, I was going like every fortnight into the Kawikas and the Rohinis. And yeah, that was where I started to like, I still don't think I've solved it, but I started to really
put the pieces together.
Yeah, started to find myself in places where there was sign and sea deer and spook deer and stuff like that. I was like, oh, okay, so I'm closer to the right track.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, it's been a very slow journey. It's over a number of years, but actually the number of days hunting is still not heaps.
Not a lot of actual time in the bush, but yeah. I mean, at least you can say you're a self-taught man. you know, I had the luxury of being dragged out hunting with my dad and my granddad and I think there's even pictures of me in like, not maybe not the front pack, but definitely in the backpack with mum and dad pig hunting. Like, so it's, you know, I've had the luxury of having, I don't want to blow smoke up dad's ass too much, but good hunters with me all the time, you know? So it must be a different story when you're just like trying to figure it out by yourself or with mates who also aren't, you know, haven't been living it their whole life.
Yeah. And like, I wouldn't recommend it. it's pretty disappointing. But yeah, luckily I've just got that real bloody minded determination that, well, I have so much fun out there as it is, so that's quite good. And then the odd time I have shot an animal, you're like, this is absolutely shit hot. So
yeah,
that's the gigantic windfall that you get from going hunting. The actual going hunting part is freaking awesome.
yeah there's so much to hunting that isn't just the killing. Like, I mean, I think not long ago I was watching on your Instagram story, you were out, and I don't think you've seen anything that day, but you're taking heaps of pictures and stuff of like weird fungi and mushrooms growing on trees and shit. And that's like, that's one of those things where if you're not out there, you don't even know this stuff exists. But while you're out there, you see all this like cool plants, weird, like we got some like weird shit that grows on the side of trees and stuff, that it's cool to just stop and watch that shit.
Have you seen that stinkhorn thing? I saw it in the car we could say. It looks like a friggin' alien. It's like, looks kind of like orange coral. And yeah, it's like an octopus or a squid or something. It's super weird.
I don't know if I've ever seen it. I'm going to have to look that up later. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I was hanging out with my gran the other week. And she was like, oh, have you seen, is there wild ginger in the bush? I'm like, oh, I don't even know what that is. So then you go out and you like try to find some pictures of that. And then when you're walking around, you just might see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like wild clematis, I saw that in the Kawikas, and it was as a seed head. And I was like, oh, is that old man's beard? And so messaged the likes of Dave Norden and the sort of doc ranger that was facilitating, or actually the trapping group, the Kiwi trapping group that's on the Kawikas, and they were like, yeah, that's the native clematis. And so now when you're like driving through bush, and like even from Tokorora to Taupo, and the little pockets of bush, at this time of year you see clematis on top of the tree, you're like, oh, that's cool. And like
knowing now that you like know what it is, you see it all the time kind of thing.
Yeah. And up in McKenna, there's a bunch of mistletoes. So there's like the blue triangles on some of the big trees. And yeah, then you walk down and you look up and you can see these mistletoe, and sometimes they're in flower and you're like, that's awesome.
It's cool stuff. I need to, it's something that I'm not like good at.
Neither.
Knowing trees. And I just did a week up in the Russell Forest, doing some goat culling for the Northern Regional Council. And lucky enough, I've been doing a bit of work lately with my old man, because he does the same sort of work. So I'm up there with that. And whenever I'm hunting with him, like you're just walking around and he's like, what tree's that? What tree's that? What tree's that? And then, or he'll throw you a seed and you'd be like, what's this? And like, I'm fucking shocking. But every now and then I'm like, oh, this is that. And then he's like, yeah, mean, like he's got such a grasp of, especially in Northland, of all the trees that are up there and the different seeds they have, and how the seeds smell and what time of the year the seeds are there, and this flower and that flower and just the bark of a certain tree and everything. So something I'm trying to work on, but I am terrible at.
Well, it's the same here. Like around Waikato, there's still little pockets of native bush, and then So we've been on one of the reserves, went for a walk there as a family, and I was like, oh yeah, there's a lemon tree, there's a torchwood tree, you know, you're going around, and then there's a little walkway that tells you at the morning, you're like, oh, this is awesome. I can increase my knowledge too. Well,
really. Yeah.
And then the other week we went on a pretty reasonable walk in the Porirua together, and like again you see like some of it's young stuff, some of it's big stuff, and you just like looking up at these big trees, and then you know there's areas where the undergrowth is all like eaten out and deer have been through, and you're like, oh yeah, that's deer, and then like deer trails and stuff off the track, and you know you can point out, well, I point out to the two girls, you know, that's where the deer go, and see up there that how that spur is like kind of more open. And that'd be weird. Try and go hunting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah. You don't see anything, but hey.
Yeah, they got to be there. They got to be there somewhere. With more of your outdoor shit, you've done a couple of ultra runs.
Or yep.
This weekend doing the, was it the Taupo 50 as a pacer for a mate?
No, so he did the Taupo 100.
Taupo 100.
I got to pace him the last 24Ks. So, yeah, it was a really good paced trail for, you know, half marathon. It was quite nice. Enjoyable.
I noticed that in the videos you were putting up, he was looking absolutely rooted and you were just big grin on your face having the time of your life.
Pretty much that. I was just sort of running behind him, you know, give him the odd bit of encouragement every now and then, and then talk shit and, you know, try to crack the funnies. You know, he'd laugh every now and again, but yeah. He was definitely in the zone, that was for sure.
Yeah. It's definitely a, it makes a difference when you're absolutely rooted like that, having a mate just cheering you on like that, eh?
Yeah. When they got to Kinloch, he was sort of with a group of four or five, and the guys he was with all ended up finishing together. But we sort of got to the start of the peninsula and started to climb up the hill, and he sort of said to me, I'll go in front and you just sort of keep him behind me. And we just sort of left them in the dust and started picking off a few people that were in this sort of similar situation. I think like aid stations semi-helpful, but then they also, you know, lose your momentum. But then on the flip side, if you're in a shit state, if you reach an aid station, they can be an absolute savior. So
yeah.
Yeah. There's one guy, Murray Taylor, and his pacer was there, and we were sort of yarning, and he had done pretty well through the 50, but then through 60 odd Ks, he'd sort of started walking and not feeling too good. But again, he got paced over the peninsula, and they ended up, you know, chewing up a bit of the time with that help. So the guy that was pacing him had been to Mount Blanc, so he's a pretty good, pretty handy guy to have.
Yeah. How does the pacing work in that event? Like how is there a limit to how many Ks you could run with them, or what kilometers you could run with them? Like,
I think it was just that last 24 was all you were allowed to do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So there was quite a lot going on at Kinloch. So there's 50, 70 and a 24 all came through Kinloch. And then there was a bit of a team relay that was sort of stationed at Kinloch as well.
Oh, it's been a busy time.
Yeah. So it was pretty busy there at Kinloch, but
yeah.
Scott had been out and had checked in with his runner and a few points, and I don't know if he'd gone to the aid stations or something and along the way and just sort of, you know, give him a helping hand. But I just met my mate here, and like I say, he'd sort of found a little posse of people to run with, and they were all having a reasonable time of it, helping each other along, which, yeah, you kind of got to do.
Yeah. Those long runs are brutal, and you've done a brutal long run. The Aotearoa Ultra down in Canterbury, when was that? Banks Peninsula, was that 2020, 2019?
January 2021.
21, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. It was again pretty mint conditions, like a good inversion layer over the peninsula, and it didn't really burn off till about more 1 or 2 o'clock, and that was you know, I had 15 k's to go, so it was manageable, so I didn't get too hot or anything like that. But yeah, Mount Herbert is pretty bloody big going up and then steep coming down, and yeah, my knees started to get pretty sore coming down. Like I was at the gondola 2 weeks ago and looking over the tail end of Mount Herbert down to Giddy's Pass, and I was like, oh yeah, no wonder they're hurt. That's quite
it's a good hill, eh? Where did that start?
So we're at Port Lee. To the other, and then we went up this big long forestry road up to the top of Mount Herbert. So that was in the space of 21 k's. We went nearly 2,000 meters of elevation, and then we sort of ran around the top of Mount Herbert, and I was feeling awesome once I was up there, and then you just kind of get on the backside of Mount Herbert down to, I can't remember what that little hut is that then drops down into Giddy's Pass, and like it was one of those like pretty almost straight down type vibes, and
yeah
too much braking, and my knees and hips started to get real tight, and you know, hard packed forestry tracks was starting to be pretty sore, and then road from Giddy's Pass up the Bastard round to Kennedy's Bush. And then you had to go then down Kennedy's Bush for like 5 k's into Hallsville Quarry. And again, that was pretty hard packed clay, old forestry. You know, I guess you could call it soil, but it's pretty hard.
It's an old track or road or whatever you want to call it through there. And it's packed. Yeah.
Packed down dusty shit that people ride mountain bikes on. And yeah, that was pretty cool. But
and yeah, how long was that one? Is that a 50 or?
54. So that was about seven and a half hours or 7 hours 40 or something like that. So yeah, started to get pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Headspace got a bit weird. And that was the thing with my mate. He'd done 50 in Noosa in March and had a similar situation. So that was what was really cool about Saturday, to see him, you know, run so strong for 100 k's, 12 hours 40, that's pretty good going.
12 hours 40, shit, that is good going, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
a lot flatter.
Yeah.
100 k's is 100 k's. Jeez.
Oh, 100 k's is, like, it's a long way.
What did you try to do last year? Were you trying to run across from coast to coast up north? Is that what you were trying to do?
So is that the start of this year? Yeah, that was the start of this year. Start of February or end of January or something. Have you read the book The Comfort Crisis by Michael Oester?
No, but I keep hearing about it often.
Read it. It's outstanding. Ryan, ask Ryan for his copy. He's a big fan of it. So there's this like concept in there they talk about called misogi, which is like just this like really fucking hard thing. And he like kind of breaks it down and comes up with a couple of rules. Rule one is you're not allowed to die. Rule two is it's got a whatever you try to do has to have a 50% chance of failure.
Yeah.
And then rule three is that you're not allowed to like boast about it. It's not about, so like it's not like, hey, check me out, this is what I did. It's like you are doing it for you just to fuck yourself up and try and become a better person because of whatever challenge you set. So I like convinced a mate that it'd be a really good idea to run from coast to coast up north, from Ocean Beach at Whangarei Heads to Bailey's Beach on the west coast, just out of Dargaville. And we grew up in... Sorry?
Is that Into the Wind as well?
Well, I don't know, maybe.
Do you get a prevailing westerly up there?
Oh, you do once you get to the west, yeah. It would have been Into the Wind half the time. It wasn't that windy that day, so the wind was definitely not the biggest of our concerns. But essentially it meant we ran from the east coast near my parents' place into Whangarei, across to Dargaville, which is like where we grew up, and then from Dargaville out to the coast. I think it was like 113 Ks all up. And we'd said, we'll run this together. So if you're faster than me, you're going to have to slow down. If I'm faster than you, I'm slowing down. We're running this together and we're going. And so we started running, and he'd like done something to his knee or his hip or something. So he was looking pretty ugly at the 30K mark. And then, yeah, we just ran all day. I got the shits at one point. Like, I had to have a crap on the side of the road a couple of times. That was less than ideal. I think there was vomit at some point.
Oh dear. What were you fueling with, or sort of plan?
No, we had a pretty strict like fueling plan that was, so we had, as part of the rule number one, you're not allowed to die. We had both our wives were in a car following us that had a big sign on it saying runners ahead, and they had food, and every 45 minutes they'd beep the horn.
Yeah.
And they'd give us something. They had food, they had electrolytes, and they had water. I think it might have been like we're taking like 600 mils of water every 15 or 20 minutes, and then every 45 minutes there was food, which was mean. Like, I think as far as like fueling for a long run goes, it was like fueling was not an issue because we were just like, we're given good food right there or go. But, and then as part of the whole, like, you got to have 50% chance of failure. We never trained for it as though we're doing an ultra marathon. Like,
yeah.
My training for it essentially was, I just did 75 hard for like the 83 days prior to it or something, and made most of my workouts be runs. And
yeah,
I'd do like either, yeah, just like, you know, get about an hour or 2 hours of running in every day. So like, I wasn't doing big long runs, but I was just getting kilometers on my feet. And so when it came to the time, just running all day was like, well, good. But in the end, like, things were good at like the 75K mark, somewhere just before 75Ks, Shane was like messed up, and he just said, nah, bro, like, you go ahead. I'm like holding you up here. So that's when we decided to like split off, and I kept running. I think he made the double marathon, and then they pulled him out. They made the call to pull him because he was like going into shock. He was fucking all cold and shit. Like, he was a fucking mess. And then I was all good until just as we were coming into Dargaville, and it was like 80, maybe just like late 80s, early 90s, and like, like, prior to this, like, things have been going not bad. Like, obviously, shit hurts. But, like, at one point, I was doing, like high 6, low 7-minute kilometers, which, like, I'm not a fast runner. So that's, like, madness for me to do that far in. I'd, like, randomly start crying. And Steve, who was pacing me, was like, why are you crying? I'm like, I don't know. I can't stop it. Like, it's just happening. And then you just, like, stop crying. And then... just as we got into Dargaville, I started getting like cold as fuck, and then I'd be hot. Things were not going good. I was like trying to talk to the missus, and I was just like, started breaking down crying. Like, couldn't like comprehend what the fuck was going on, and then kept going. And I got 97 Ks or something, and just like fucking collapsed on the side of the road, and was like, just fucked, and I couldn't get back up. And then that's when Tony was like, "Nah, you're done, mate. Stop being stupid. Get in the car."
Rule number one: don't die.
Don't die. Like, that's, and I look back at it and I'm like, "Oh, you pussy, you could have made it." But every time I mention that to T, she was like, "You couldn't make it. You were fucked." Like, and then I ended up, like, I got in the car, we drove to a mate's place, and I'm like shivering. I think I threw up in the garden. I got in the shower and I was cold, and I kept, she wouldn't let me touch the temperature because I was like, it's fucking cold. Like, we need to turn it up. And she's like, I've already got it really hot. If you turn it any hotter, you'll burn yourself. And I was like, fucking turn it up. Like, I was just like, so rude to that.
Temperature's up there, lad.
Yeah. But like, you know, I, 50% chance of failure. Well, I failed, but like, technically, you know, technically it's a fail, but you learn and you do it. And it's like, I now know, like, fuck it. You'll be fine. Just keep going.
Oh, mate. And that's like, that's what comes in so much handy when you're out hunting. Like, same like on walking that southern access, it's long and shitty and it's just like tussock. And then you like, oh, there's another bloody hill. Oh, there's another bloody hill.
Yeah.
But you can just call on that and be like, oh no, it's like, actually only, it's only 200 meters. And it's only like, once you get over the hill, you've ticked off 2 or 3 Ks. And, you know, I think the biggest thing for me with going hunting for a long time was like the shelter idea. And like, I've sort of got the tarp thing going at the moment, but then I'm like, oh, I now need something to attach it to. And so, yeah, that was what I was most nervous about on walking there. I was like, oh, where am I going to camp? But then you do it and you're like, oh, it's not the end of the world.
No, you can find a place to camp. You can camp like pretty much anywhere, eh? And one thing the old man used to say to me, actually, like, he'd always say, if people come to him and said, like, oh, I want to go hunting or something, he'd like half jokingly, but kind of serious, say to them, like, if you want to do this, just go spend the night on the lawn. No tent, no sleeping bag, spend the night on the lawn. Because if you can't do that, if shit hits the fan while you're out in the hills, there ain't a fucking shit show in hell you're going to make it through the night. So, yeah. Like, just kind of put yourself in some sort of uncomfortable position at home where there's not really any, like, serious consequences. You know, you could just, if shit hits the fan and you're on the lawn, you can come back inside with your tail between your legs and go, okay, sweet, I gotta try again. But like, if it happens when you're out there, you know, it ain't gonna work. And a couple years ago, I was like, I don't know, it came up and I was like, actually, I've never done a night out where I have just had nothing because I've never needed to. And I thought, fuck it, the weather's looking like all good this weekend. I'll go hunting and I'm not taking any rain gear, I'm not taking a sleeping bag, and I'm not taking a tent, like any shelter. And like, to put this in perspective, like, because that, you know, someone will hear that and think, you fucking idiot, but like, I was going somewhere where, like, I know I can walk back to the car in a couple of hours, and I knew like shit wasn't going to get terribly bad. And while I was in there, I also happened to see some people. So like, I knew, like, you know, things weren't too bad, and I had half bad cell phone reception. So like, I'm not going to fucking die. So I just went out and spent the night. Like, it started raining. Didn't rain. Yeah. Didn't rain real hard. And I just like, I ended up just lighting a fire under a beech tree and just sitting there and, just had like just a bit of a fire, and I pretty much stayed up most of the night just reading a Louis L'Amour book because it was too cold to fucking sleep. I didn't get much sleep in, but I look back at it and I'm like, you know, you've done that thing that
like petrifies you when you go out hunting. Are you like, oh shit, what am I gonna do?
Yeah, and like, fuck, I wouldn't want to do that in the middle of winter on some tar hunt somewhere because it will actually be miserable. But
yeah,
it's like putting yourself through those little things that seem a little silly to like manufacture that challenge for yourself. But I suppose if you don't do it, how do you actually know that
Yeah, it's like the sort of exposure therapy to like reduce, because it basically is sort of an anxious feeling about it. Like, oh, and that can sometimes prevent you from going or getting started. But yeah, the closer you are to actually knowing, okay, the better you have, and the further you can go, and the more confidence you can have to, you know, stay out that extra 20 minutes and maybe walk home in the dark and you know, increase your opportunities, eh?
Yeah, exactly. And it transfers over to like other aspects of your life. Like, for example, like starting this podcast, this is something that I'd wanted to do for years, but had always kind of been like, you know, who the fuck's going to listen to this? And then I was like, fuck it, I'll just do it. And if it's shit, no one's going to listen to it anyway. So no one's going to like judge me. So like, so it doesn't matter
anyway, so don't worry about it.
And like, you know, still no one listens to it, but I have a hell of a lot of fun doing it, so I'm like, fuck it, this is cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. there's a post on LinkedIn the other day from a guy that runs an agency in Auckland, and they've got a couple of podcast rooms. So part of it was about drumming up business, but the other part of it was, you know, because I've started their own podcast to try and promote their business and marketing and stuff. And he was just like, you know, be prepared for, you know, nothing to happen. And I sort of made the comment there, like, yeah, be prepared to do 100 episodes and no one listened. He's like, yeah, I was so stoked when I finally got 50 people listening. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, because what are you? You're 310-ish episodes now or something.
Yeah, I recorded one last night, so it's going to be 308 sometime soon. And then we'll record some at the Seeker Show as well. But like, yeah, it's you know, there's not. I've had stints there where I've had amazing months, and then you just get brought back down to size, and you're like, oh, I don't know how this hits with different people. Like, oh, it just amazes me how some things will get all these plays, and then other ones were just like, it'd be radio silence. And like, what happened there? And it can even be like guests that are like in theory popular, but like in terms of other people listening to them, they're clearly not interested. You're like, oh well, don't move on, carry on.
Yeah.
It's there forever, so it'll eventually get listened to.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I think the episodes of mine that have done the best, I think the first episode we ever did is still the number one episode, but the number two episode, I think, is the one I did with Stu the other week, and it's like the latest one. So it's crazy the difference in just in reach that episodes can get through so many different factors. Like,
so, yeah, Stu's got some notoriety though.
And he's just like, I think he was the first guest I had on who like just like punished the world with clips on. Like, usually it's just me just like punishing the world with the clips, but he got on board with it too, and I think he's got a bigger reach than me anyway, so it like really fucking helps. Whereas like when it's just me and Jason, like Jason's a massive introvert. It's hard work to get him to do an episode, and which is annoying because he's so interesting to talk to, but he hates like social media and all of that. Like, it's not his thing. So getting anybody to like know about a podcast I do with Jason is hard work.
Yeah, mate, that's why I'm always keen to like give it a share, because I know how hard it is to like get some reach and stuff. That's just kind of like I say, Stu, you know, he just shares it. He doesn't care. Like he says, anybody making content out there, I'll share it. He's such a legend.
Oh, that's cool, eh? That's good. Health and fitness. You're quite big on, obviously, fitness and the running stuff we've been talking about, but getting out there and doing workouts at home and jumping in the bloody, going for a swim in the lake and things like that. I suppose through your sports, you've always been pretty keen on the whole health and fitness side of life. Like, what's your go there?
Whether it's like mental skills or just, I don't know, trying to find an edge. It's probably from being a little bit of a battler and having to work that a little bit harder, not being, you know, got a reasonable level of talent, but then you play with people that are just freakishly talented and you're like, geez, I've got to work a lot harder to compete with them. So, like, I've lived with, so Pat did the run. I flirted with him in Auckland and he did sports science. I was always talking with the physios, just talking with the strength and conditioning coaches and the teams. I had a really awesome football coach when I was growing up, John Herbin, who has gone on. He coaches the Canadian men's team now, so like he gave us heaps of information. My dad himself, like was a professional rowing coach for New Zealand Rowing for a while there. Like I've had him. Both my grandparents were coaches in rugby and rugby league and swimming and stuff like that. So like I've always been surrounded with that sort of hard work, elite mindset, technical aspect, like dive deep into how can we be better type mindset. And then with optometry you just see people that are so unhealthy, and like part of it is my grandpa sort of he died of diabetes, and then in my work I see diabetes all the time because the eyes are the most sensitive to diabetes, and so like you just see catastrophes from the vessels inside of the eye bleeding. And then with kids, often it's sort of their nervous system and how they sort of interact with the world a lot of the time, like affects how they can see to read and concentrate and stuff like that. So I look at that a little bit. My Bachelor of Science was in reproduction, cellular anatomy and neuroanatomy. So I looked at the brain, the reproductive system, and then the cellular system. So that's kind of how I see the world. So I've got this broad base of interest that then sort of flows on into my life. And I can listen to the Peter Attia podcast and sort of follow along what he's talking about, and can read his book and what he's talking about, or Andrew Human. I don't really listen to him that much, but Human, Rhonda Patrick, or all these people that Rogan ends up having on. Talk about James Will when they talk about the studies and stuff like that. I can sort of understand what they're getting at, and so then I just try and bring it into my life and try live that longevity life where you can be strong and fit and healthy for as long as you possibly can, and hopefully it's a short, quick end. And
it's one of those things where there can't be any harm in being healthier and fitter in there. You cannot lose, so why not?
Right. Like I said in my job, you'll see people at work just with, chronic conditions, and it's years and years of chronic conditioning. That just doesn't look fun at all. So it's pretty motivating. There's a couple of things in my job that I wish I got paid a dollar for, and one of them is it's not easy getting old. I hear that multiple times a day. And then the other one is when I tell people to look to the right and they look to the left, I will show you. You're either right.
Oh, you can't get it all, eh? Circle. Circle of Savages, man. Have you been ripping into this month's mayhem?
No, but There's this thing called the Clifton Strengths Finder that has 34 strengths and ranks them for you individually, and competitions my highest strength. And seeing you and Kane and then catching MNZ not quite crack the 5 minutes, knowing that played sevens at Canterbury, we did the Bronco and I think I did 4:24. Oh. So that was running beside Sam Dixon, the New Zealand sevens captain.
Yeah.
And I headed faster than that. So I think Bowden Barrett's time's 4:17, and I'm pretty sure that day I'm pretty sure that day Sam did 419 and I did like 424 or 28 or something like that. So yeah, I'm definitely keen to go out there now that I've done this run and try to do the Bronco. And of course, the Murph's always, you should have went to Murph a couple of times a year.
Yeah, I did the Murph today.
I did the Murph when I had COVID. That was not a wise idea.
Murph sucks. So today I did the Murph, and that was the first time I've ever done the Murph not, like, the last few times I've done it, I've, like, used bands doing the push-ups or of, not the push-ups, the pull-ups. I've, like, used a band or of, like, put a stepping block there and, like, kind of taken a little bit weight out of it with my legs just to, otherwise I could just fuck up. But I've been like working on my pull-ups and I like today just busted, did I say bust them out? It didn't, that sounds so much quicker than how it actually went. But I just did sets of fives and just ticked away at it. And I think it was like 50 something minutes. I was like, fucking, I'm wrapped with that. So
yeah,
I'm going to try and do it again before the end of the week with, I don't think I'll be able to get a hold of a weight vest, but I think I'll just whack some weight in my backpack and do it weighted just because, fuck it, why not?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there is some guys around Tokoro that do have weight vests, so maybe I'll grab one of them. You've seen old Justin's taken up the daily Murph. There's a few people, like Garrett GMNZ had that massive run of doing Murph, did it for a year.
Yeah, he did it for a year. That was...
I think Justin's done that before, and he's doing it again at the moment. Chase and Gather, Mike, he's been doing quite a few Murphs lately. Yeah, there's a few people out there Murphing it.
It's a good workout, eh? Like, it kills you. Yesterday I did... what's it called? Death by burpees. So you do on every minute you do the work, and the first minute you do one rep, the second minute two reps, the third minute three reps, and you keep going until you can't do the reps within the minute.
Yeah,
I was sure I was going to get into the 20s somewhere. And like I was on the, like, trying for 15 and I only got 14. Fuck, it pissed me off. I was like, God, you're pathetic.
Yeah, we did that 1,000 burpees, I think, in February. And then that kind of in February because I was on gun leave. That must be in April. That was brutal. Yeah. The running challenges haven't been too bad. Rucking, that wasn't too bad. Swimming, that was my idea, so I'll take responsibility for that. That was fine, but
I didn't do swimming. I was nowhere near swimming pools for the entire time. I was like, just fuck it, I'm skipping this much. Which kind of pissed me off because I thought it would be cool to lock in the whole month, but the whole year's worth. But you know, what happened last month actually?
Kane needed a month off.
Yeah.
Matters, they crop up.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Run into him in the Necky or no?
No, he actually lives not far from me at all. I actually drove to his driveway the other week I was trying to go up the mountain and I like turned down the wrong road because I still don't have a fucking way around here. And I like turned down the wrong road and I was like, sweet, this will take me up and then I'll turn off this road onto that road. It'll get me there. And I just drove and I got to the end and I was like, oh, for fuck's sakes. And like turn around, come back. And then I was chatting to him like later that day and I was like, fuck, I was actually on your road. And he's like, yeah, that's my driveway. So it was a bit of a laugh. But no, I've never actually run into him. But I'm going to try and get him on the podcast at some point because it seems like a cool dude.
That'd be a cool thing. He's got a good book too. Yeah.
Yeah, I've read his book. I've got that sitting on the bookshelf here somewhere. But that's a bloody good book. If anyone hasn't read that, Tools for the Top Paddock by Kane Briscoe, highly recommend.
Absolutely.
He put up that story today on his thing with his book next to David Goggins' book, and it had like a comment about how it, I don't know what it said, like, do cool shit and you'll get your book next to a legend. And I sent him a message. I was like, fuck man, your book was better. we'll wrap it up there, mate. I've got one last question for you, and that is, what would you like to ask the next guest?
Oh, yes. I'll ask them what I ask everyone, and that's what keeps them in flow. Yeah, what's the sort of way they live their life, and good shit happens when they're doing it. So yeah, that's what I'd ask the next person. What's the thing that when they do it, good things happen, and if they're in a rough patch, they call on that thing and things turn around.
Well, that's bloody good. And I'm actually going to ask you what keeps you in flow, because you ask everybody that comes on your podcast what keeps you in flow. And I've always thought it's interesting what actually keeps you in flow, Ryan.
Yeah. So I have a mantra that's improve people's lives, help them see the world to the best of their ability. So I have that written down in my journal. And then I just sort of try and live that. So like you say, I will try and check in with myself by writing journal, or try keep fit, or, get straight in the shower and turn the cold tap on, remember to breathe, try and eat good food and hang out with good people and have good yarns. So that's what I'm trying to achieve, is improving people's lives. So yeah, that's me.
No, that's bloody brilliant, mate. And I think you're definitely doing that through your podcast. There's, for myself, and I know for others, there have been some great lessons that I've learned, and there's some awesome guests that you've had that I didn't know about. And then after listening to them on your show, they have then provided value to my life. So bloody keep up the good work there on the show, and thanks for what you do with the Stag Raw, because it's bloody good. Quick plug us, where can people find you? Obviously, yeah. The Stag Raw.
Yeah, pretty easily found. I'm like pretty much on every social media, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. I'm on Instagram on two places, Stag Ryan and Ryan O'Connor NZ. Ryan O'Connor on YouTube, or the Stag Raw on YouTube. The podcast is on pretty much any podcast app, the Stag Raw, or if you searched Big Game Records, or if you searched 200 Club, 400 Club, 235 Club, you'll come across some of the stuff that I've done. I've got a blog, stagryan.com, got a newsletter, so yeah. One channel leads to the other, so if you find one, you'll find them all.